Thank you for joining us on LHP. Joining me as he is just gotten his costume from a closed costume rental shop, Eric Sayor.
I thought you said a Michael Myers mask and not a Michael Myers mask. So here I am looking like Michael Myers, not Michael Myers.
This is Michael Myers. Yes, exactly. Exactly the right energy. So we're
this is a Baby Driver joke, a movie we're not talking about today.
No, we're not talking about Baby Driver, not talking about Kevin Spacey. But there will be similar conversations that we would have about that. So yes, it'll be no, we are talking about the final Stanley Kubrick film, Eyes Wide Shut. We're starting at the end.
We haven't done, I mean, I feel like we've talked at least a bunch about The Shining, since yes. It's one of your favorite movies that I watched on your recommendation a long time ago, before we started this show. But yeah, this is our first time covering Kubrick, and this is a movie I hadn't watched before. Had you watched this before?
No, this was it's one of those that we've been doing lately where it's just movies that have been on the list that I just hadn't gone around to yet. I'm very happy that we did this one.
Yes, yes. This movie, right, I think, away. Had the reputation historically as being kind of a messy last movie, kind of a miscast. But I feel like its reputation now is firmly that it's one of Kubrick's best and one of his masterpieces. At least that's how it's talked about, I feel, in a lot of film circle. I see. I'm definitely on that side of the fence after watching it. I really love this movie. I think it's so well done. It feels like three different movies, kind of. There's definitely like an erotic thriller in there. There's like a failing wedding drama in there, and there's like a detective movie in there. And all of it fits, I think, very well. I really enjoyed it. What did you think?
I mimic a lot of your thoughts. I was compelled by it. I was entranced by a lot of it. I was also impressed by a surprising lack, I guess, of the flourishes that I guess I would associate with Stanley. And I would almost call it like a maturity. And then there's also this other aspect to it, which really gripped itself tightly onto my brain, which is like this sort of cult mastery to the movie. Felt very much like I was watching an occult ritual being done. So a lot of interesting layers to the film that we will talk about as we go along.
I feel like a lot of the Kubrick obsession stuff comes into play more in that this movie was not shot in New York. It was shot in the UK in a studio because Kubrick was known to be afraid of flying. So he didn't want to go to New York to shoot it. And he just recreated meticulously New York streets in a way that's like, if you've been in that area, it's like, it feels so exact, like it feels so on the nose. I never thought for a second that they weren't in New York.
No, and I was thinking about it the whole time, because that's one of those factoids that you hear about the movie. And I was paying extra close attention to the inserts that were clearly like a second unit person. And I'm sure I know already, but I want to know the story of the person who did the second unit stuff, because who did Stanley trust enough to do the second unit for Eyes Wide Shut? That has to be a fascinating story all on its own. I was even looking for little details that you'd think would give it away, but I didn't see very many, which means he had to build some of those apartments probably from scratch, I would assume, which is, yeah. There's a lot of like film nerd stuff that you could geek out about and spend all your time on with this movie. And I do feel that there's a lot of Stanley Kubrick intentionally playing with that crowd of people who are just needlessly technical about movies.
There's we'll get into it, but there's like some lighting stuff that's incredible. I feel like there's like a, I mean, the orgy scene feels like so designed in a way that really is really impressive. Did you watch the which version did you watch? Did you watch the one that's censored or the one that's uncensored?
So, I didn't look into it. I knew that this was a thing. But so the version I watched is whatever's on the Canadian Netflix, because I was using a VPN to watch it on Canadian Netflix.
That's the uncensored version. I checked because I watched, I don't know, I put on my Apple TV, just play Eyes Wide Shut. It played on Crave. And and then I was like, there's some weird blocking in that this scene. But I guess it makes sense because, I don't know, maybe this... I didn't really know about that before. Yes. And then I looked it up after, and I was like, "Oh, okay." And then I went on Netflix, and I was like, "Oh, it's the uncensored one on Canadian Netflix."
Is. There are two documentaries I want to say, one much older and much more recently, about the American MPAA, who are responsible for that edited cut where he had to CGI in extra cult members. Fascinating documentaries to watch on your own. I think it's called This Movie Is Rated X or something like that. And it's all about how the MPAA is basically a censorship organization that refuses to call itself one. Very fascinating story, again, for another time. I knew about that even before. That's the thing. Like, this movie, it is one of those where there are so many stories about it that you kind of know them beforehand. And I was very impressed by how none of it like harmed my opinion of the film. That was a weird experience of like having this preconception of things that you would expect to think about a film with that. I don't know if you felt similarly. I didn't find the cult stuff salacious or titillate even. Like, I found it very cold and very like.
It feels very designed. It's like you're watching a museum exhibit and going through it slowly, and then it's like you're very. I think the movie does a really good job in putting you in the place of the character, and he's not really like he's more confused than horny.
Yes.
I feel like in those moments, the whole male bit of the movie, like Tom Cruise character Bill, is so. It's so kind of lost in like this idea that he has to be horny, but he's not really kind of, while he's walking through all those people just fucking and, an orgy, right? It's like just everyone is in a mask and a lot of people are just in cloaks and watching. And he's just walking through it like it's really like it's a museum with the stuff happening on the side. And I don't know, it doesn't feel... I was definitely expecting something... The way people talk about this movie, I was expecting something more debaucherous, like you said. And it doesn't feel like that because that's just the way it's shot. The other thing I wasn't expecting is... This movie has some pretty funny moments. Like, it's not... Yeah. It is, like, it has, like, a lot of comedic the touches. There's like bits in the middle, especially with the shop owner, that are very funny. And I mean, Kubrick does have this reputation of being like not funny.
He does.
And I don't think I totally agree with that. Like, I mean, even 2001 has like funny moments that are voluntarily funny in there. Yeah. But
there's a lot of in jokes in like the toilet, which a lot of people didn't realize.
Yeah.
And then of course Dr. Strangelove, which is a hilarious movie still to this day.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And this is like it is like a you know, this erotic thriller, but it does have those little moments of like it has like those the movie I was thinking about a lot during that night out, especially, was After Hours, the Scorsese movie. And it just has this there's like After Hours absurdity of stuff happening around him. Even at the end when there's this, the guy following him around, it feels like a little ridiculous. But it's almost
like the less coked up older sibling to After Hours, the yes. more mature. Yes. Yeah. No, that's a good comp. Like, there's a similar propulsion, especially in that middle section as you're just following him through that night.
Yeah, we can go through what happens in this movie, because there's a lot that happens and I think it's worth getting to the bits. I mean, I kind of, the opening I think is very good, because immediately you see Nicole Kidman naked, and getting dressed and being basically like the sexiest woman alive she is at this time. Like, this is post, or is Titanic the year before, the same year? I can't say. But it's around the same time as Titanic, where she's like, she plays an incredibly beautiful woman in that. She is an incredibly beautiful woman in this. But the first thing you see, like, you see her get naked and you see her taking a piss. And it's just like a reminder, oh yeah, these sexy movie stars are just normal people. And then there's the little detail of like, oh yeah, there's this like, there's classical music playing in the background, but it's, he turns it off. It's like, oh, there aren't like, it's not the movie putting classical music to tell them that it's, that tell us that they're like this super rich couple. It's like, oh, he likes to listen to classical music because it's what he's that kind of rich guy. They go to this party to thrown by Victor Zegler, who's one of so Bill Hartford, he's like this like rich people doctor. He makes a lot of money, but he's like he's your doctor, right? He's like on the side of that circle. He's invited to this party, but he doesn't know anyone there. The only person he knows is the pianist, because they went to medical school together. And yeah, what do you think about that party? I think that scene just, it sets up the movie very well.
Yes, it's a lot of plans and payoff stuff is set up there, but it's just very it's very alluring. Like, you kind of get into like the vibe of this couple and the way that they are at this party, and you feel the chemistry that Kidman brings out of Tom Cruise, even when they're not right next to each other, even when they're like looking at each other from across the room. Like, there's this vibe that it sets up, and it just kind of like slowly invites you into who these two characters are. And it's an extremely good way to start the movie, to start there, to precede that with some of the family stuff and the way that they are with their daughter a little bit, and then go into that party. I really like the character who I've identified in my notes as I'm Hungarian.
Yeah, the Hungarian guy.
who is delightful, and he's just dancing and flirting with her. And I like that the movie, it's not a bait and switch, but like it gives you the sense that these are two people who they like to socialize. Like socialization is part of their relationship. And until later on, when you get the sense that things are a little bit more tense than we're led to believe, you're kind of led to think that they purposefully go and sort of flirt around the room. Or at least that's how I felt at first with that party.
It's like they're you see them like looking at each other and like both having this moment of like I don't know, kind of like like not freedom, but like they're just like letting themselves go a little bit, but not too much. Like they have limits imposed upon themselves. And she's, I mean, her talk, her flirting with the Hungarian man, and then the dancing, and then the teasing. It's the sexiest thing in this movie. Like it's so, there's so much tension there that's portrayed. It's like, I mean, I think it's the sexiest thing I've seen in a Kubrick movie at all. Like, yeah. I was like very, I mean, I haven't seen, there's a couple of movies of his I haven't seen. I haven't seen Spartacus. I haven't seen Barry Lyndon and Lolita, which I don't know how sexy those three movies are.
I have seen Spartacus, and like, I guess you could say Kirk Douglas has some chemistry with some of the other gladiator characters.
Yeah.
which is interesting in a 60s sword and sandals movie. there's a little bit of that, but not much. He doesn't really do sexy. It's not a Kubrick calling card that I think of.
The killing has some moments of like more like lust. I mean, it's a noir in that sense, but I don't know. I've honestly rarely seen scene in a movie where there's so much chemistry there and it's so well, so sexually portrayed. Like it's not just Kubrick, it's just everyone, right?
Tom has more chemistry with his female co-stars in this movie than I've seen in any other Tom Cruise movie. Like, it's not just him and Nicole Kidman. It's him and just about every other actress in the movie. I felt his chemistry more. And I don't know if that's just the meme of Tom Cruise doesn't have chemistry in Whispers, Tom Cruise is gay. I don't know if it's just the meme of that or if it's just that the movie really, it's part of the movie. It's part of the fabric of the movie, so you notice it more. But it really stood out to me how electric the interactions between him and his female co-stars
truly is. Yeah, I feel like there's just a large difference between Tom Cruise, like, pre, I'll say, like, 2002 and post-2002 or something like that. Yeah,
Magnolia.
Like, around that
time. Let's use Magnolia as the...
Yes, exactly. Where, like, Magnolia, the last, like, one of his last, like, performance where he kind of gave himself to a director without like having total control of the project, which like does some very fun movies we both love now, but this feels like I'm watching an actor. Like it doesn't feel like I'm watching Tom Cruise.
They're cold, and his interactions with female co-stars, it's very cold in the way that Marvel movies tend to be cold when there's a relationship on screen. It was really shocking when he had so much chemistry with, I'm blanking on her name, but Top Gun Maverick.
I was going to say Emily Blunt in Edge of Tomorrow.
Sure.
But
Blunt, yeah. it's hard not to have chemistry with Emily
Blunt. Yeah, she's the chemistry.
Yes, and I'll give Rebecca Ferguson credit there as well. But it's very rare when it does happen, when it's noticeable and notable, when, you know, I mean, we discussed at length, I believe, that Michelle Monaghan had to be in like 3 movies before I remember really feeling any chemistry.
Makes
that part of the film though, and I think that and it's really interesting. I think that, so this is where the sort of real life stuff comes in. I think there was some really smart casting here with these two and their very public relationship, which imploded shortly after this movie came out or around the same time. And I think I had never heard the miscasting thing before, but I think that it's interesting how people in taking in the art at the time really, I think, got it wrong. I think the fact you can feel the fact that these are two people who do have a genuine attraction to each other. And I think that greatly impacts the movie. I don't think that ending speech, not to jump too far ahead, I don't think that works if these two don't have a lot of chemistry with each other. Yeah. And you really believe their relationship. And I think part of that has to come from the real life, very explosive relationship.
The other thing that happens at a party is that he's talking to these two models, and then he's interrupted by the host. Someone working for the host that asks him to come up. And this is where there's the distinction, right? He's still like the doctor for this guy. He's his employee. Yeah. He's not like, he knows no one at the party because he's just not in that social. He's not in the same class as them. Like, there's a very evident, like, a lot of this movie is like Tom Cruise interacting with people of lower class than him and higher class than him, and just being kind of in this weird middle that he doesn't realize he is really. Yeah. So he's sent up. And there's this woman that overdosed that he basically just like. He talks to her into waking up, and she kind of makes it, and it's like this very like, I don't know, it's this very, like you said, there's like even chemistry in that scene. It feels like he feels so sweet in the way he talks to her, just managed to bring her back and then tells her to stop, stop doing the speedballs, like that she'll even next time she could just die, that's more or less what happens at the party. I mean, then they have the next night, where Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise are spending the night together, and they have a joint, and then they get into this big argument. About like, I mean, starting with like, oh, were each other jealous about the what the other did at the night previous, and then he talks to her about she asks him about like how he feels when he's touching like a beautiful woman's breasts as patients, and he's like, I mean, it's just my job. Like, I don't care about these women. Like, and they're worried about cancer. Like, there's nothing going on there. And he's like, and he basically has the like very classic like misogynistic thing about like women don't feel attraction like men do. Men are dogs. They're attracted to beautiful women. That's why this man was talking to you. If I'm talking with women, it's different. Because I love you and I'll be faithful to you and I believe this. And then she tells this story about being in Cape Cod and that there was a naval officer there and she had a fantasy about him and that she would have left him and her daughter just to spend a night with him if she had had the chance. But it's all just a fantasy she's talking about. It's nothing that actually happened. And it's... and their conversation just gets interrupted by a phone call because one of his patients died and he has to go to her side, to his side. But the whole conversation is really... Like, Nicole Kidman is incredible in it. I mean, they play, like, high so well. It's like very like sativa high, right? It's like a high energy conversation, but like just the way they hesitate before talking, the way they're like, the way she laughs for way too long when he tells her that he trusts her basically to not cheat on him and to out of love for him and her daughter. It's very good. That whole scene is so well acted.
Yeah, it's I wrote in my notes. It's probably my favorite Nicole performance I've ever seen. If I had to like pull out a sheet and write them all down, it's up there with. She has this monologue in one of my favorite movies, Stoker. somebody put that on a graph of how many times I've brought that movie up. It's up there with her monologue in that, like with how magnetic she is. And very convincingly high in that scene. I do want to point out just one funny little thing. We never see Tom Cruise actually puff. We cut away and he is clearly puffed, but he never puts the joint to his mouth. Which is just an interesting little thing that I wrote. And also, I want Eric's our little reoccurring segment. How do you feel about the way in which he holds the joint, Eric? Did you realistic?
I don't smoke a lot of weed. I don't know where this is coming from.
No, but the smoking, just smoking in general, did it feel...
I mean, the way she... Look, there's one thing that's very evident that is well known, is that smoking in movies is the sexiest thing you can do on screen.
Yes.
And the way she smokes, so good. Like,
she's a pro. She clearly knows what she's doing.
Yeah, she rolls. She smokes. It's very casual. It's all well done. I think that it has like the moment. He, like you said, he doesn't really puff on screen. So I don't think I paid too much attention to that part because you just get the close up of her. So I wasn't thinking the shot of her smoking definitely in my mind with him behind her. Very, very sexy, very, very intimate.
It's a good scene. It's a great example of how a scene can escalate. And you don't know how you got there. You're with the characters and not fully understanding how it went from like you said, something very intimate and something that, again, the vibes feel good. And then it sort of just goes a different way. It just goes there.
I don't think this rich couple with this beautiful bedroom would have smoked in bed. They wouldn't want their bed to smell they would have smoked by the window like normal people, but
sure.
But it's not as sexy. I guess maybe it's their little Christmas treat, smoking in bed.
It's December in New York, I know a little bit about that.
Yes, yes, of course.
So that is from everybody I know of who's been there even longer than I have, which is only like a weekend, freezing cold, just hell in the winter, so I can appreciate it. You make a good point that like they're just rich enough that they would be worried about it, that they would be concerned about the smell and how they present to people, to real estate people and that kind of thing. Good point. But it's in the middle of the scene, you don't notice it. It's one of those after the fact things that stands out. And like you said, it's broken up by him getting the call from the patient. The whole sequence of him going to the patient, that scene has this interesting vibe, which sort of carries through most of the night as he sort of goes from place to place. There's like, it almost becomes almost Lynchian, from here, for a good section, specifically like in character interactions. I think it's explained really well, though, that it is late at night and there's this different vibe that the nightlife has.
Yeah.
It's like you're on a different planet in some cases. And like the elevated emotions really.
I mean, also it's around Christmas, right? Emotions are at their peak. So you get a very, so he goes to this man's bedside. He died during the night, and then his daughter is talking to him, and she's looking like she needs to tell him something, and it's like eating her on the inside. I really like her acting. I think she, there's a lot, so much happening in her face, and you're like really, you're really seeing it. She's played by Mary Richardson. So, and then she kisses him and tells him he's in love with him. She's in love with him. He's like, we've basically never talked before.
Yes.
They just met. She's supposed to marry this professor and they're moving to Michigan, but she's like, I just want to stay in the city and be close to you, even if I can't be with you. And it's kind of like completely ridiculous. And then her like fiance shows up, this guy named Carl, and he just looks like Tom Cruise in a way that's like that's like so funny immediately. It's like, oh yeah, she just found a guy that kind of looks like him, but just not as good.
Yeah.
Other than him being a lot taller, but
yeah, true, yeah.
It's just like, oh yeah, they just have the same facial structure. She just built this thing in her head and found a guy that kind of looked like him. It's very funny. So this guy comes, they shake hands, he leaves. He's kind of weirded out by the whole experience. And then he meets, like, while he walks, he's interrupted by like a prostitute called Domino. That's like, do you want to come to my place and have fun? And he's not sure. And then he says yes. And he's so awkward the whole thing. He's never thought about doing this. He has never no idea what he's doing. I mean, a lot of it feels like kind of he's confused by his conversation with his wife, where she said to him her desire for that man, and then the kissing scene. It feels like he's really lost in all of this shit, and he goes up to her apartment, and then she says I think something like, so what do you want? And he's like, whatever you recommend.
Yeah,
which is such a bad thing, like such a dumb thing to say to a to a sex worker. I mean, yes. And she takes him to her room and kisses him, and then his phone ring. His wife is just like, I don't know, eating cookies and doing a crossword basically in pajamas in her kitchen. It's very cute. I feel like it's like, are you coming home tonight? Should I wait up or not? And he's like, he kind of realizes what he's doing and how it makes kind of no sense. So he tells his wife he'll be out for a long time, and then pays the sex worker and leaves. And then, continuing his walk home, it's on the same walk. He sees the jazz cafe where jazz bar, where his friend, that the pianist at the party that we mentioned before, is playing. So he sits down, the set ends, they have a drink together. Also, the pianist is played by Todd Fields, director of Tar, which...
Okay, I didn't even connect the name, but no, that is absolutely him. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense now. The movies are funny in very similar ways, actually, now that you point that out. I did not even realize that. The jazz, the vibe of the jazz bar is interesting. And I like the way that Tom Cruise just sits down and I don't know. There's this interesting energy that he has observing them, even as they're closing their set out. I think Todd Field, he has just like a strange chemistry with Tom as well. I don't even know how to describe it.
I mean, yeah, they have this energy of they've known each other, but they don't know each other anymore.
Yes,
it's like seeing an old high school friend. Like it just fits that vibe really, really good. I feel like, and yeah, there's some like there's another thing that's like very like. The way he orders the beer is like, this is not he doesn't fit there as well. Like, he's not an artsy New York guy that goes to jazz bar. He's just a guy, normal Midwestern guy, maybe like anywhere. He could be from anywhere in America. He's not from New York, that's for sure. But he goes in and orders any beer, and there's no wherever he is. I don't know. It's a little detail that I found, like, and then Nick orders, I don't know, a gin and tonic or something like that. People would order more at a jazz bar. I feel like,
You go to, exactly. That's what you get at a jazz bar.
You get a cocktail, you get a glass of wine, a beer, a beer that you ordered. Like, I'll have a beer. Very movie like,
But there's a lot of that with the Tom Cruise character. Later on, he orders a cappuccino, and he just orders a cappuccino. He doesn't say anything more specific than that.
Todd Field and Nick, the pianist, tells him about I'm going to this gig. It's all secret. The location changes every time. They gave me the password. And it's like they cover my eyes, and I saw one time they didn't cover my eyes super well, and I saw some of the most beautiful women I've ever seen, and it's all like masks and cloaks and stuff. And since he's having the weirdest night of his life, Bill is like, okay, tell me where it is, I'll go there, I'll give the password, I'll get there by myself. They won't connect us. So they split up, and then Nick just goes to his gig, and Bill goes to this costume shop where he knew the owner because it was his client, and then the owner is gone. It's like there's a new guy. It's like that tells him, oh, my, the owner moved to Chicago. They negotiate. The new owner is like this Eastern European accent, I think, guy. Very like, kind of, what the fuck are you doing here? I don't really care about your story. And then he just offers him $200 plus the price of the costume, and he takes the deal. They go into the costume, and then there's the most outrageous scene in this movie, where there's like a little room in the back of the shop, and there's a bunch of Chinese food, and then the shop owner goes in there, and then his very young daughter, 14, I guess. I feel like that's how you're supposed. Somewhere between 14 and 16, like 13 and 16, I'd say. And two older Asian men wearing makeup, it like yeah. all in like underwear. You don't know what they were doing, but they were doing something. And then the dad is like, I'm going to call the police. You're going to go to prison. My daughter is underage. And he screams at his daughter, what are you doing? And then the daughter kind of just hides behind Tom Cruise and whispers something to his ear, like a little joke. And she leaves with her little grin. It's very weird. It's very funny.
Yeah. Again, just strange vibes all around.
Yes.
Yeah.
The conversation about like what mask do you want, what cloak do you want, all that is very funny. It's very like completely surreal.
I think she says something about the cloak, and I don't even remember what she says specifically. Like, your cloak should have this inside of it. And then she sort of like disappears. Like, she there's this like weird dream quality again. Like I was saying, Lynchian to this entire interaction and those two men, who get locked in that room, if I remember correctly, just in this glass room, just sitting there with Chinese food it's probably like cold and like
starting,
you know, and those two actors, I don't know them specifically from anything, but they seem to have very long careers. One of them looks like he was in a Star Wars at some point. Interesting. One of them was in a Lynch movie. One of them was in Elephant Man. They have a very specific vibe to them as well. And they really sell the comedy in like, again, in that strange love vibe of just like kind of elevated, but also they're not there for too long, so you don't really get a too big of a sense of them. But when they show up later on, like there's this there's just something that they sell that I think really works for the scene. And then do we go directly to him
getting
in the cab? And
he gets in the cab. The cab takes him to this mansion where it's like visibly all limousines in front. Like, he got there in a cab. Yep. He gave the driver half $100, told him to wait. He'll pay for it. He pays so much cash in this movie. I don't think I've ever had that much cash like on me.
Nope.
I guess the last time I had that much cash on me was when I was 18 and traveling and just couldn't rely on credit cards like 12 years ago or something.
It's literally like I've gotten some pretty wacky birthdays and Christmas in the past from like relatives who don't necessarily trust the federal government. We're like, here, take this cash, and I'm immediately like going to a bank and depositing it right away. And I'm like, and that's about as close to that as I've ever gotten. I've never just been like, I'm running around with $300 in my pocket. Insanity to me. And it is crazy. I think he must be carrying like $1,000 with him, if I'm right, because it's the same it's the same night, and or it's the next morning where he's paying in cash for the costume and the mask that he loses. Presumably he hasn't gone to a bank in between that. So yeah,
I mean,
he's carrying
it also feels like when he's doing like some of these private house calls, when there's like prostitutes involved, it's like they're paying him in cash. So he probably has a lot lying around. Anyway, he pays this cab driver to wait for him and goes in, says the password, a car takes him to the house, and then it starts out as this like a ritual. And then he walks around, and then there's this orgy, and then there's this woman there. The woman you learn later that it's the woman that he saved at the beginning. The sex worker that had an overdose, that's trying to warn him to get out of there. He doesn't listen to her. And then they're about to, and then they like bring him I mean, they lead him into the middle of this the circle where he has to unmask and take the judgment, and she does this big gesture where she says that she's sacrificing herself. She'll take his place to repent his sins or something. Because they ask him to take off the mask and then to disrobe completely. I guess, I mean, we'll get into maybe like what the interpretation of it all later. But yeah, that's what happens. And so he kind of just leaves and goes home. And then Alice is having, his wife is having this dream where she's laughing. He wakes her up and she tells him about her dream, where, which is very similar to what he just experienced.
Yes.
Where it's like she was having sex with this, with the naval officer, and then multiple men were having sex with her, and then she was imagining him watching her have sex with all these men, and that's what made her laugh. And the way that's like when he comes back, the way it's shot, where it's like very early morning, it's all like blue light. It has this very like a dreamlike feeling, when especially even more when she's telling her dream. It's really, I mean, I think the lighting in that scene just like already, it looked so good watching him walk through the house, but there's this scene where they're together. It's really great. One of the best scenes in the movie.
Yeah. There's so many, like, so there are a lot of little choices that come along in this entire section that I think are just, I don't know if they're there to draw attention to themselves or if they're there for a purpose. Like, I wanted to ask you about this. Why do you think there's this constant Mike kiss during a lot of that orgy scene? And like, there's like an effect on his mask. And I don't know if that's just to amplify the dreamlike quality. Yeah. In which case it's doing its job. I think it does add to that dreamlike quality. And like this weird, like almost like his mask isn't in the scene, as if he was like wearing a black mask and they just did some sort of special effects matting to put it on there. Or if it's just something he did with like the lighting or the painting of the mask so that it looked weird on camera. I don't know what it was, but it just has this like weird otherworldly quality to it once he's at the party that it doesn't really have when he's getting it from the mask shop.
At some points it looks like there's the white part under on his face. Yeah. And at some points it just looks like his face, and it's all like, it's kind of like the way it changes, sometimes just based on the lighting, I think, yeah, there's definitely that effect there. I mean, all the masks at this party look, are all completely different, and they all have like their specific, style.
Very Renaissance painting.
Yes.
Boschian, some of them even. They kind of set up the reveal with the Sydney Pollack character. I think that's what they were doing with the character up on the balcony that we see.
Yeah, it feels like that's like supposed to be him. I don't know. We already talked a lot about the orgy scene, that's why I jumped over part of it. No, I mean, the ritual itself is interesting. I mean, it's so elegant how it's shot, I guess. It's like the visual of it all, and I feel like the camera stays in a very like point of view way of it. Like it's not, it feels very like you're all these people watching it instead of being like, I don't know. I'm thinking of something like the new Suspiria, where like all the dancing scenes are very like, okay, look at all of this from the up or from the side. And it's all like impersonal. This feels very personal, and the lighting is all very, gives like this effect that it's just like, you're in some place that mixes like old and new in a way that like there's this like aristocratic feel. Like it's shot kind of like a movie set in the 1700s or something.
Yeah.
In that way.
It connects back to the other movie that we were considering doing for this, Barry Lyndon. Like it there's a direct correlation there. I think he's doing a similar lighting technique, and it has that similar vibe, but he's not doing this thing that he does in that movie where he'll just hold on shots forever in that movie. Like he'll let a shot just sit. And this is, I'm just stealing this from Brian De Palma, where he says the reason why he would hold on a shot for so long is to get you into the time of that, of when the movie took place, to give you a sense of how time worked in the minds of those people. And this movie, it's doing a lot of that same stuff visually, but it still is, it's maintaining the time. Yeah. Like it's maintaining a synchronization with our current time. And I think it's interesting how you can use the same effect in different ways based off of how long you hold on something. And it's, like you said, it doesn't feel impersonal. It feels like you're there. When we transition into the morning stuff, and I think that why it sort of brought me back to that party is that when we get to the second morning and it's the mask on the pillow, like that effect is still there. And I think it's interesting how the artifacts from one scene sort of, they like maintain how they are in that other scene when they're in. This is a very complicated thing to say. I don't know if I'm explaining it right. There's this weird vibe of like that mask is the way it was in the party while it's on the bed next to Nicole Kidman. Both of those morning scenes have this specific vibe where you couldn't mistake them for other points in the movie. Like they just,
yeah.
Like you're saying, like there's this, the blue lighting, which is just, it's not the sort of overdone blue and orange.
No, it's all blue. It has like this kind of melancholic vibe just because of the color of it.
But it's not quite pastel either.
I think it's, there's another thing is that during that scene, he tells her it's 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. But this is December in New York. Like, there wouldn't be any light at 4 o'clock in the morning. This is like 7 a.m. So he's just lying to her about the time it is. Six or seven. Like, it's way later than he's telling her. And that's that's just the effect that lighting gives. I think we can talk about what happens after that. Because this is when this movie becomes this like weird detective movie. One of the funniest thing about this character is the way that he uses like his medical license, like he's a detective flashing his badge. It's completely ridiculous. Every time it's so funny. I feel like it's supposed to be funny, right? It's supposed to be like.
It might also like... be, you know, he might be making fun of the people in those scenes. Like, it's the sort of, adherence to authority, I guess, is sort of what he could be commenting on there. This sort of, like, something like that. But it is definitely meant to be funny, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he becomes this kind of little detective going around and, like, thinking there's a huge conspiracy all around him. And
it becomes conspiracy thriller in a way that I don't think I've seen. It doesn't feel like the Bacola movies, or like a Hitchcockian thriller. It has its own very particular vibe to it, that feels otherworldly.
First thing he tries to do is go to Nick's hotel, and then you're. I don't know. But I was there. Like, why is Alan coming there? What is happening? So there's this moment where, she goes there. He talks to the clerk, and it definitely feels like Alan Cumming is playing gay and hitting on him. And he's like telling him, like, yeah, the guy came, he had the bruise on his face. There's these two big guys with him. And then he left in a rush. And the big guys were polite, but they were big, big guys. So he tries to go to, I mean, first he went to the cafe next door to the jazz place and talked to the girl there. This is one of the times he flashes his like medical license and, yeah, I'm looking for him. He's my patient. I have test results for him or something.
Well, so that one is a hospital, right? Am I mistaken?
No, he goes to the coffee shop, to the diner next door, and then flashes his license, and then she, the woman at the coffee, he gets coffee, it's a diner.
That one is very strange.
She knows where the hotel is. I guess he's trying to guess if she's been to the hotel with Nick. Because it feels like there's some, I mean, it feels like she's like, oh, he's there. He's here on the time. I know him very well. Anyway, he goes there. He does a license thing again to Alan Cumming. And this is when, like, I think, oh, yeah, this is when he goes to return. After that, he goes returning the costume. And then you get the kind of really fucked up moment of like the store guy who's basically selling off his daughter now. Like, what happened during the night with those two other guys is that they paid enough money to do whatever they want with his daughter, and then she's for sale now. It's so fucked up. It's like, and it's played like it's played so weird, and he's like, he has so little care for the whole situation. The night before, he was like, if she's underage, you need to call the police. And now he's like, okay, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's really that part is really, really fucked up.
I don't even know how to describe it. I don't think it's one of the things you have to see it. Like the way his interaction with Tom Cruise and like he's very much speechless in that scene. And he just doesn't know how to put his thoughts together. And he's, you know, having sort of the beginnings of this like reexamination of like, wait, was that a setup? Was I supposed to come to this costume shop? Like you sort of see the seeds of that, and the way that that thought develops. I think Tom Cruise does that very well, and he and all these different mixed emotions coming through all at once in that scene. Again, as the two Japanese men exit the scene, and they're just like very like, you know, nonchalant, like have a good day. And it's the lack of intensity, I guess, like the way in which everybody else is just they're very chill. The only person who I would describe as not chill is the daughter, played by Lily Sobieski, who's just like giving Tom Cruise eyes, very flirtatious eyes the entire time. It's very
very and she looks like even more like a child than the scene before, right? It's yes, like it, there's like this innocent childlike look. It's very it feels so uncomfortable for us, right, watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And for Tom Cruise, who's just like the most confused man who doesn't know what to think about anything. So after that, he returns to the place of the orgy, and then they bring him this like
piece of paper. Bring him like a letter.
There's this letter that's like, yeah, so this is your second warning. Just leave it alone. Move on. he drives all the way there just to get that and just go back. And then I think this is when he like tries to call the Marion, the girl that kissed him, but he talks to Carl instead. Like Carl answers the fiance, and he doesn't speak and just puts down the phone. Then he goes to Domino's, the sex worker's apartment that he was in before. She's not there, but her roommate is there. And then there's like a little like sexual tension scene. And then the roommate tells him that Domino did a test and she's HIV positive. And he's like, damn, that sucks, but I'm glad I didn't sleep with her.
Right.
I'm not gonna sleep with a prostitute anymore. This like it's so he's so selfish in these moments. It's pretty clear, like, okay, something shifted in him that he's like kind of like wants to know what happened. Especially what happened to that girl that did the sacrifice, I'll say, in the ritualistic way, like not in a, I mean, we don't know what happened to her basically.
Yeah.
But also like he sees this girl that's this child that's basically a prostitute, and he's this other prostitute that has HIV, and he kind of feels nothing for them. It's very like, okay, I'm I care about these things, but I don't care about these other things. I mean, it's like he just wants to know, and it's like it's not even out of care for people. I feel like he's kind of detached by the whole thing, but also I don't know, he was like it still doesn't feel like he's horny. He's just calling these women because it's like, I don't know, maybe I still want to have sex with someone that's not my wife, just as a thing to do. So yeah, this is the point where he's starting to get followed. I mean, noticing the guy that's following him, they're just like very like tense piano playing. He gets a newspaper, goes into the cafe, orders a cappuccino, and sees this article about the girl, Miss New York that died, and he knows that he recognized her from the beginning of the movie, and then he guessed that it was her that was trying to ruin him at the party. So he goes to the hospital where she dies and goes see the body. And then Ziegler calls him, and they have this, and then there's like this confrontational moment where it's like Ziegler is like, I was there, I knew you were there, but you're thinking there's this like, yeah, it's all like rich politicians having like nasty sex and cheating on their spouses, like whatever. Like you're imagining some. Not there, like yeah Nick got beat up a bit, but we sent him home to his wife. He's probably having sex with Nick's wife. I think that's the way he says it's funny. And that woman that died, she just died of an overdose. You told her yourself that she would die from she was an addict, she could die the next time, she just died the next time, it's a coincidence. I had you followed because I was worried you were gonna do something dumb, so that's why I'm talking to you now. And like, Billy, like, this is clearly like when the, I don't know, it's like, what is really going on there? Is
yes,
cult? Is there, is it all in his imagination?
Is there a cult?
I mean, no, there is a cult, right? There's a thing going there, but did they kill off those people, or is it just like? No, it's like he's making way more out of it than it actually is going.
It's interesting. So it plays with these concepts that are, it plays with a lot of concepts that are part of actual cult thought, which is like it's as real as you want it to be.
Yeah.
It's as real as you want to make it to be. And it like really, it really sells that perfectly. And I think it's, you know, again, I think this is why Tom Cruise is a fascinating person to cast in this role. Cause he's from a, he's part of a religion, which is part of that lineage. It's part of this occult lineage that goes all the way back to Aleister Crowley and rich British people doing these exact same kind of, you know, faux rituals, you know, thinking that they're summoning, you know, the Whore of Babylon and so many other things, guardian angels, that kind of stuff. And so it's interesting to cast a person who is part of that lineage, who believes that you can just like focus yourself into not having a cult and to cast that person in this movie that is very much about like, seemingly at the end, it's like, do you believe that she killed herself? Is that what you want to believe? Is that what you think happened? And it's like, it's not telling you how to interpret the movie. It's asking you to like exist in that sense of, I don't know. And like allowing you to complete the circuit in a really interesting way that I just don't think I've seen many movies that do this this well and have like this real sense of knowing unknowing, I guess, that I got from the movie of just like how much of it you want to believe. And then, you know, it's underlined with that scene with Nicole when they're in the store, you know, and her line, which I wrote down because it really stood out to me. Whether they were real or only a dream, excluded line, the reality of one night, or can the reality of one night ever be the whole truth? Like, it's a really interesting exploration of, like, what is reality in the context of one man and his relationship with his wife and the society that he is, or the segment of society that he is part of but on the outside of at the same time. And yeah, great film.
I feel like in the end I kind of land on the side of him being just kind of like making too much of what he's seen and everything being like because this move, everything that's happening to me is so like enhanced in a way. Like it's all I mean, everything is perceived through him. Even back to the beginning when these two models are flirting with him and they're like, we're gonna take you to the end of the rainbow or some stupid thing like that. I'm more on the side of like, oh yeah, Ziegler's explanation makes sense enough.
The explanation of it being theater also checks out.
Yes.
What, you know, again, to go more into real life stuff, in cases where we have found cases of stuff like this existing, you know, the I can't remember the full name of it, but I think it's a something Grove. I can't believe I'm forgetting this, but it's in California, and it's very much this. It's like a campsite that a bunch of rich people go to, and it's like every other weekend or something. And they go there and they bring prostitutes in or sex workers, and they have sex literally everywhere. You're not allowed to bring wives with you, and it's like, don't ask, don't tell. You don't tell who's there and who's not. And it is literally, again, it's like Sidney Pollack says, it's people who, if you knew, it would blow your hair back. And they go there, and they have like a weird like ritual where they set a giant owl on fire, and they whisper chants to each other. But it's like theater kid stuff. Like, the reality of it is very much like a bunch of theater kids going camping. It's just like they're all rich and they're all probably kind of lame if you got to know them. So their perception of this stuff is very much colored by how lame and like old man that they are. They're like, oh, this is so cool, we're wearing robes and we're setting a thing on fire. It's like, it's Burning Man for like everybody's 50-year-old dad. And like that the reality of that, it makes me believe that like a lot of this was theater, and it was theater for Tom Cruise's, for the character Bill, for his benefit, this is something that some of these groups do. You know, they will recruit you by, you know, playing a little joke on you, a prank, hazing, and that all that really fits for me. But I think the movie, it does an effective job of like, if you want to read it the other way, you can. And I think that, again, that's very effective for me. It plays to this nature of like the lines between dream and reality very well. And I think the way that the movie never indulges in like true, like the dream breaking out and like taking over in ways that would feel unnecessary, so that you can feel that way at the end.
I feel like that's the strength of it all, is that like both are very possible, and there's the subtlety of it all. I mean, I really love the scene of him coming home and the mask has been put there by someone on the pillow next to his wife, and it's like and he just breaks down. But I really, really love the ending of that movie, where it's like bringing their daughter to do some Christmas shopping, and then he asks Alice, what should we do now? And she's like, there's one thing we really need to do as soon as possible. And he's like, what it is? And she's like, fuck, and then credits.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, we both failed to have sex and wanting it kind of in the last few couple of days. We just need to have sex now. like just to get it out of our system. And yeah, that's a wrap. I mean, great movie.
Especially after talking to you, I'm like, oh no, I love this movie.
Yeah, it's so good. Great. Yeah, it's really great. Is there anything else, or should we just do some plugs?
Let's just do plugs. I think
this is a meaty one. Well, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. I'm at ECUR. Then you can also look into my friends on Letterboxd and find Arlen there.
Yeah, you can do that. You can find me. I'll bring my profile up real quick. Find me there. Arlen Haro is, I think that's, yeah. Or AA Haro, if you want the link. We have a Phantom Zone stuff. We recently released a nearly 3-hour episode with all of our top fives. A crime was committed on that episode because nobody picked Andor. And I'm angry with myself.
I can't believe it. I can't believe you didn't pick Andor.
I thought somebody else would have, and nobody did. So there will be a fight about this on the next Phantom Zone that you hear, probably. So, look forward to that.
I mean, at least we had like an hour or more of Andor content on here, so maybe we didn't need to talk about Andor anymore.
We made up for it, and that was my thinking as well, is that like Hunter would probably have said Andor, and I would let everybody else talk and just throw a little things in. But there's somebody who is refusing to even watch it. So assuming I remember to bring it up during that episode, that will be an interesting conversation. Other than that, that's all I got. Bye.
Bye. Fuck Scientology. Bye.
Fucking stalking and all the other terrible things that Scientology does. 'Cause we're the